You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting on KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to the November 23rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Allison Kulo, in this run-up to Thanksgiving. How are you this morning, Allison?
Doing well. Thank you, Roger. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we got some light clouds, and I think we're expecting maybe a little weather later today. But first, we've got a pretty interesting program this morning. First, we're going to start with Katie Welking of Cushman & Wakefield, who's going to provide us with insight about what's been going on in the commercial real estate market.
Then we're going to speak with Brian Richards. He's the executive director of Mountain Town Music. He's going to join us this morning to talk about the impacts of COVID-19 on the local music industry. Charles Marone, founder of president of Strong Towns, talks about Strong Towns' call for a bottom-up revolution to rebuild American prosperity by making communities stronger and more prosperous.
We're going to end our hour with talking with Jonathan Wiedenheimer, the Park City Economic Development Manager, about Small Business Saturday this coming Saturday, November 28th. All this and more on Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Katie Welking is a director with Cushman & Wakefield, focusing on commercial real estate in the area. You know, we've talked before about how there's been a dramatic increase in activity in the residential real estate sector and some significant price increases. But how is the pandemic and the post-pandemic, which I hope to be in soon, affecting commercial real estate in Park City? Good morning, Katie. Maybe you can help us answer some of those questions. What's the commercial real estate market doing?
Good morning. Nice to hear from you guys. Hope you're doing well. Can you guys hear me?
You're doing great. Thanks, Katie.
Okay, wonderful. You know, it's been interesting when the shutdown happened and COVID first came about in early March, we were all extremely concerned about what was going to happen with our market. Same with residential. We haven't been seeing the same booms that residential has been having, but we've been having a lot of strong changes, positive, I think, in our market. A lot of movement, a lot of money coming in for investment, and it's been really impressive seeing the businesses get creative on how to stay open.
So let's start first with businesses who had to close due to COVID-19 impacts. We know we've lost a few in the community. Roughly how many were there, and was it contained to either a certain industry or a certain geographical location?
Sure. You know, we have seen a couple actually choose not to open back up after the shutdown. I think very few of those were due strictly to COVID. I know some of them that chose not to open were probably having some challenges in their business in the first place. We saw it from office, whether they realized work from home worked for them, so they didn't need to have the overhead of an office space. I know some retailers chose not to open. The shutdown was too much to handle. Where I saw it hit businesses pretty hard was new businesses who had just opened and either didn't have the bank account to stay afloat, or they had just spent all of their money on tenant improvement build out. They may have had a higher lease rate because it was a more recently signed lease. And so we've seen it across the board from retail to restaurant to offices. So I wouldn't say one was hit worse than the other, and I wouldn't say it was necessarily a geographic location when considering Park City. You know, we're in a bit of a bubble here, which we like compared to big cities were hit really hard. But just talking about Park City, we were very happy with how few of businesses had to leave. And sorry to hear about the ones that did.
You know, it's interesting, Katie. We've read a lot about how one of the results of the pandemic has been an increase in allowing work for home and work from remote locations, particularly in the larger cities. And that's perceived as a potential long-term trend. Meanwhile, we're seeing a lot of people buying real estate and working here from here in Park City. Are we seeing a reflection of that in a continued demand for office space? In other words, are we seeing the same kind of declines in office demand as you're seeing in some of the larger cities?
In the beginning, we did, and there was a lot of talk about how dramatically office was going to change. But with the length of time that this has been going, we're actually seeing some positive changes with office. For some people, work from home is great. It works really well for them. And offices are realizing that they can downsize, that they don't need You know, the big reception desks, the multiple conference rooms, and all of that, because Zoom is efficient. People can take calls from home. The technology we have has really made that an option. On the flip side, one thing we saw before COVID was a huge increase in the co-share, the co-working spaces. And I know those businesses are still doing well, but we saw a decrease in square footage per person down to maybe 100 or 150 square feet. But with COVID and the social distancing, we're now seeing this trend called the socially distant office. So people have more room in their office spaces, specifically enclosed offices. So even if you and I were in the same suite, we could each go into our individual offices and close the door and feel safe and contained there. And we're also finding that some people have a really hard time with work from home. I know that specifically millennials who really looked to their work as their social outlet, to meet friends, to get out of the house. Also, they tend to be in smaller homes, maybe don't have a home office, and or younger children at home. So we are still seeing a strong push for to still have office. It's just changing. And a lot of people, you know, I think it takes a special breed of person to be successful at work from home. So we're just seeing changes, I would say, versus a decrease.
So I want to go and talk about the commercial properties, perhaps more, you know, storefronts. But definitely in the spring, we heard of many instances where property owners were working with their tenants, whether that's reducing rent, postponing rent, or even eliminating rent for a couple of months. So with that, is that type of assistance still going on? Are you hearing that people are still having a very active relationship with their landlord?
You know, I think it was really neat to see how landlords and tenants worked together. And that was one thing I was really proud of Park City. We have a large amount of local landlords, and they know their tenants, and they chose to work well together, whether it be free rent for a couple months or decreased rent or deferred rent. Most, I'd say at least 90% of my tenants are now back to paying full rent. Perhaps if they had deferred rent, a lot of landlords ask that they come current within this calendar year. For larger tenants that have pretty high overhead regarding their rent, maybe they came current within their lease term. We also saw landlords choose to renegotiate if a tenant, say, only had a year or two left on their lease. Landlords worked with them, and maybe they signed an additional 3 years and got reduced rent this year. But overall, I'd say that most people have come current or are back to paying full rent. And I do have some landlords, because of the environment we live in, that's so seasonal and so tourist-based. If tenants have a really tough winter due to COVID, specifically restaurants, if they lose some outdoor space, I know that landlords have said, if come spring, you can show us that you had some pretty dismal numbers and you're really struggling to stay afloat, let's talk and see if we need to do something.
You know, Katie, you touched on the tourist-driven nature of some of the commercial real estate. Obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding what this season is going to look like. But what are we anticipating in terms of the sort of really resort-like properties, some of the stuff, for example, at the base of Park City? What's going to happen to that real estate, and, you know, how are those relationships progressing?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think it's a bit of a wild card. The retailers that I have talked to at the base of the resorts actually feel pretty optimistic, and I think that could be our defense mechanism. But I think that I've talked to some ski rental places and some restaurants, and they're feeling pretty good about it. One of my clients actually has higher ski rental numbers than they did last year. Granted, a lot of, you know, hospitality and outdoor retailers are seeing cancellations, especially with this uptick. But for now, I think we're feeling pretty strong. And you know, Vail really supports their bases and what's happening there. So that's a positive. And we have a lot of new properties coming online. And so I think there's a lot of optimism out there. But I do have to say we're going to have to wait and see.
Katie, when we see the resorts sort of trying to create demand, you mentioned that you're seeing a lot of cancellations. How is that affecting the sort of commercial environment for lodging. Are you hearing anything about problems with respect to being able to maintain rental property revenue streams in the lodging sector?
You know, from a hospitality standpoint, I think they are also hoping for the best. I know that they have done things like dramatically increased their cleaning services. They're having purposefully planning vacant nights in between hotel stays. Another thing that I've heard, which, you know, has helped the residential market, but a lot of people who had second homes here that used to put them in a rental property are now staying in their homes. With that said, I think from a commercial standpoint, those are people who are coming in and choosing to invest in commercial real estate. So it's a bit of ebb and flow and give and take on the benefits versus the cost to it.
Katie, we really appreciate your time with us today. We've been speaking with Katie Wilking. She's a director with Cushman Wakefield and Mountain Money. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money.
Have we got Brian Richards?
Yeah. So the pandemic has taken a toll on many industries, including the arts. Park City and the area is known for its live music and is what draws many summer visitors. Brian Richards is the executive director of Mountain Town Music and joins us this morning to talk about impacts of COVID-19 on the local music industry. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, Allison. How are you?
We're doing well. Thank you. We're excited to chat with you this morning.
Well, so, thanks for having me.
Mountain Town Music has evolved during the pandemic in order to bring live music to the community. Tell us about the efforts that took place over the last 9 months.
You know, once it became pretty evident that, COVID was going to have a pretty impactful thing on Mountain Town, you know, we went to virtual streaming, you know, right away, pretty quickly. We partnered with Shannon Runyon, Park City Summit County Arts Council, as well as an organization called Muse PC, to start to virtually stream music. So we did what we call the Locals Lounge from probably the middle of March through the end of May, just so that we could support musicians. You know, I think that there was a lot of musicians that lost tons of gigs that they were counting on at that time, and it just allowed us to essentially, hey, showcase them, put up your Venmo tag, try to gain donations, and it's allowed us to stay relevant while we sort of sat in the kitchen and cooked something up, so to speak.
Brian, I don't know if you have quantitative numbers, but I mean, I'm wondering, do you have a sense of just how many individual music gigs would have been canceled as a result of the pandemic? You know, it seems like it would be massive.
In Utah or
here locally?
I mean, yeah, it's massive. I mean, it was massive, you know, it was basically a catering for these, like, local musicians, especially on the onset, you know, because people didn't really necessarily know what it was going to look like. So, you know, pretty much every restaurant, live music venue, hotel that would have otherwise been programming music at that time pretty much cut the cord. So musicians all of a sudden that probably had, let's say someone like Shannon Runyon, she probably had 4 or 5 gigs a week, and that went to zero overnight.
That's significant. And I know this summer you've been able to employ 332 musicians, but that can't be close to what you would typically see during a summer. So I'm wondering...
No, it's not.
I'm wondering just... Yeah, go for it.
Well, no, it's not at all. I mean, it's not even close to how many we would employ. We would probably employ double to triple that in a traditional summer. So, you know, again, once we looked at it and said, oh, my gosh, you know, there's going to be no concerts at Deer Valley, there's going to be no concerts at Canyons, Billy Blanco's, Miners Park, et cetera, we got to thinking, well, how can we support not only our musicians, but, you know, our family, our Mountain Town Music family, which includes our, you know, our loaders, our sound engineers. You know, we wanted to make sure that we found something for them to do, to, you know, again, to make up for all this lost income, because, you know, we plan our gigs almost a year ahead. So most of my guys and girls had probably, let's call it, I don't know, 75 to 100 gigs on their calendars going into the summer of 2020. And all of a sudden, again, they're gone. So what were we going to do? You know, it was, we research, oh, can we do parking lot parties? Can we continue to do virtual streaming? And none of that necessarily made sense. And actually, Diego from the Park City Foundation gave me a call one day and just said, hey, man, what do you think about doing some pop-ups in some of the parking lots, like Aspen Villas or Iron Horse Condos? And I'm like, yeah, that sounds actually really cool, because ultimately, you know, music is such a panacea, and we wanted to be able to provide that joy for people, right? And as we started to sort of talk about that, I'm like, well, if I do it in a parking lot, why can't I just do it everywhere? And so we started toying around with the idea of, hey, what if I got a flatbed trailer and I just towed it around town? You know, so we came up with what's called the Door-to-Door 2020, where we basically program music wherever people wanted it programmed. Backyards, cul-de-sacs, streets, back decks, you name it. We would go program music there. And, you know, we were able to do it very safely. You know, I'm really proud of the fact that we did 107 outdoor concerts, and we had not one confirmed COVID case from any of those performances.
That is amazing. One of the things that you and I talked about kind of towards the beginning of the pandemic is really how the community likes to enjoy live music. And when you bring this type of music either to parking lots or to neighborhoods, people, when they typically enjoy music, everyone goes up to the stage, you're shoulder by shoulder and you're dancing. How did you see people change this summer when they were watching this music?
I think just people were more aware. You know, they were aware of their personal proximic space, let's call it. You know, so I think that people that were familiar with each other, so households. So when we first started, we said, hey, you know, we wanted everyone to stay in their driveways. And it became sort of apparent that wasn't going to stick, because a lot of them were happening in backyards. You know, at first we're like, oh, they'll take place in streets and cul-de-sacs. But then as it morphed, a lot more were taking place in backyards. So people would just find their space. They'd set up a blanket, you know, 6 to 10 feet apart from the next group of people, and they would just enjoy the show in their space, and they would dance in their space. You know, occasionally people would get up and dance, but not very often. And so I think, again, people were just more aware of what was going on and keeping their space. And, you know, one of the things we often joke about is that music is the background to the social experience. You know, meaning a lot of times when people are at Deer Valley or the Canyons, they're really there just to hang out with their friends, and there just happens to be a band playing. And even at Deer Valley, if you notice, people don't start dancing until, like, you know, they've had a couple bottles of wine. So let's call it 7:30, 7:45, then the show's over at 8. So it just gave people the opportunity to get out and about, see their friends, see their neighbors, see their family in a safe environment, and enjoy music. And that's really, you know, I think what we miss the social interaction, right? We miss being with people. We miss being out in the sunshine. So it gave them an opportunity to just feel some sense of normalcy in such a crazy and weird time.
You know, Brian, it sounds like you guys were very creative at finding ways to do that during the summer. You know, the après-ski live music experience is typically indoors with a fire. And obviously that's probably not going to happen this year. But have you given some thought to being able to do some kind of outdoor winter kinds of venues, maybe at the bottom of the resorts or other places?
Yeah, you know what? We're in the planning process of that right now. And kind of where I'm leaning, and we haven't finalized this yet, is I believe that music provides joy. Music provides the good vibes that we need. And it's going to be a very difficult winter for all of us. And so how do we find a way to put joy into the universe, right, in a way that's safe? And so what we're going to do, I think, is I want to do pop-up concerts. So not concerts, but solo, duo, trios at possibly the Park City Hospital, so at the testing sites, so that the first responders who are there, you know, tirelessly working, sacrificing for us, again, feel the power of music. And while people are getting tested and have their cars in line, you know, there might be a musician playing. We want to put musicians at bus stops outside of where a lot of our service industry workers will wait for the bus. So before they go to work or when they're coming home from work, again, there'll be music. And we may put it at you know, the transit center. But essentially, we want to create little pop-ups throughout the winter just again to provide just some sense of normalcy. So they won't be concerts. They're just going to be music. All, you know, again, imagine coming home from a hard day's work, getting off the bus, and there's, you know, a salsa band playing.
I have this vision of some future iconic rock album called Live from the Park City Transit Center.
Yeah, totally. Totally, man. Live from the hospital.
Exactly. Yeah. But what about, again, those are more, I think those are lovely ideas, but what about sort of bringing live music to the tourists? What if anything is, are you thinking about ways to do that in this environment?
No, to be honest with you, we're really not, just because of all of the changes and how quickly they're changing. And so it's very difficult. And this is kind of one of the misnomers about the live event industry in general, right? Planning concerts takes a lot of time. There's a lot of logistics that go into something like that. And because the COVID regulations are changing so quickly, it's very difficult to sort of try to say, hey, let's plan a concert for the tourists. Let's do it at the base of Park City Mountain. Let's do it at the base of Main Street, because it's too challenging to do that and then have the plug be pulled at the last minute. Now, I'm not saying that we won't do something, but I want to do something that makes sense for everybody involved, that ultimately provides good vibes for our community. And then if we wanted to put a solo musician outside of a bus stop and the regulations change, we can still do that because, again, it's not promoting gathering. It's not promoting that. So our focus is on that right now, because I believe that our community, again, over the next 3 or 4 months is going to need, you know, music. Yeah. It's going to need that. And so, rather than, hey, let's plan one or two of these big concerts, why don't we do every other Saturday, have 3 or 4 pop-ups throughout the community? It's just more logistically more accessible and easier to do.
And I think the way that you're approaching how you bring programming to the community during this time is smart. And you're looking at it not just for the benefit to the community, but also for the long-term benefit of your organization. With that, you know, we've got just a quick minute, but how can the community support the musicians and support those, like the gig workers, during this winter? How can they help make sure that everyone makes it through?
You know, I would say support them. A lot of these musicians do weekly live streaming on either through Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. It's a great opportunity to, again, while you're cooking at your house, turn on a live stream, check out their Venmo, donate a little bit there. There's tons of live music venues in Park City and Salt Lake City that are struggling. You know, talk to your congressperson. Hopefully there's some stimulus for them. I mean, the guys that own the stateroom, that place hasn't been open since March. Who knows when they're going to be open? I mean, those are the venues that people don't realize how badly they're struggling. You know, the live events industry, you know, I think you put a question in your email, and I looked on Facebook. There's about 1,000 Facebook members of what's called the Utah Live Events Industry Association. And those people are struggling so badly because live events were the first thing to shut down, and they're probably going to be the last thing to open up. So, you know, I think it's up to us as community members to identify the needs and figure out a way that we can support not only this industry, but the people that are involved in it that are struggling.
We've been talking to Brian Richards of Mountain Town Music. Thank you for spending time with us this morning, and we'll be looking for ways to listen. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Everyone deserves the opportunity to live a good life in a prosperous place. Future generations deserve that same opportunity too. But there's a problem. For generations, North American communities have been growing, or at least they've been building. Endless roads, countless buildings, and trillions of dollars of infrastructure has been put into the ground. The Strongtown movement argues that the way we build our cities now squanders precious resources that should be used to make our communities more prosperous. That short-term growth is being traded for long-term liabilities, and it is slowly bankrupting our cities.
Charles Murren is the founder and president of Strong Towns and the author of Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. He's a professional engineer and a land use planner. He's presented Strong Towns concepts in hundreds of cities and towns across America and has been named one of the most
one of the ten most influential urbanists of all time by Planetizen, and he's joining us today. Good morning, Charles, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, good morning. It's really nice to chat with you.
Let's start with the biggest of big pictures. Tell us what the fundamental core of the Strong Towns movement embodies.
Well, back in 2008, I had been working for a number of years as an engineer and a planner, and I had come to the realization that the projects I was working on financially were bankrupting the cities I work with. They would create growth in the short term and generate a little bit of cash revenue for the community that way. But long term, they added a lot of liabilities to our balance sheet. In fact, way more liabilities, promises that we would maintain roads and streets and pipes and sidewalks and the like, than the tax base that was being created was going to take care of. And so the core insight is that our cities have grown themselves into insolvency, and we're going to have to figure out something else to do.
And you've stated that business as usual and municipal growth is a Ponzi scheme of sorts. Why is it looked at like that?
Yeah, I think it's important right off the bat to separate, you know, what we discuss as a Ponzi scheme from like a intentional, you know, fleecing of people. This has all been something we've just kind of fallen into, which is, you know, if you read what happened with Bernie Madoff, he didn't set out to create a Ponzi scheme. He just kind of, you know, one quarter fudged a little bit here and a little bit there. And pretty soon what he needs is huge amounts of growth in order to take care of past promises. That basically is what our cities are today. We have exchanged for generations now short-term growth opportunities for long-term liabilities. And now all those liabilities have come due. All the bridges we have to maintain, all the overpasses, all the pipes and the sewer systems and water systems, all this stuff is decades old now, and it's come due. And the response has been not to sit and ask, why don't we have the money to do this? You know, that would be a very sophisticated question that would lead us into a lot of uncomfortable places about the productivity of our development pattern. The question we've asked is, how do we grow more? How do we get more money for more infrastructure to build more stuff to get more growth? Because the growth will, in theory, give us the cash to pay for all these promises we have. That's a Ponzi scheme. That is essentially, you know, trying to get more entrants into the system to make up for the insolvencies of prior commitments. And Ponzi schemes end badly. I don't think we want to be running our cities in this way.
Let's try to make this sort of picture a little more accessible to our listeners. I read the piece that you had about Kansas City, and that was really instructive, because I think the nature of the so-called Ponzi scheme you're talking about has been that a traditional city pre-World War II was a compact, multi-use, integrated neighborhood concept, and we moved to something else with suburbanization. How is it that suburbanization has created this long-term demand?
Yes, we if you go back pre-Great Depression, look at cities in America, they were not perfect. They were far from perfect. But what they had was they had internal mechanisms to respond to feedback, to work things out. And so you saw problems coming to bear a lot quicker. And you saw a lot of different adaptations. You know, places would add more people, but sometimes they would, you know, do other things as well in response. After World War II, we focused our development pattern really on one goal, and that was national growth. We had just gone through the Depression. We had just gone through World War II. Yep, there was a fear that as, you know, the war wound down and people came home, that we would just slide right back into depression. And so the idea was, let's get people working again. Let's go out and build as rapidly as we can, as much as we can. And so we built the American suburbs. We built the interstates. We built strip malls and franchise restaurants and malls and ultimately big box stores. And the idea was, if we could just grow as quickly as possible, that would create jobs, create economic opportunity, make people better off. What we lost were those feedback loops. The feedback that says, you know what, when you spread out housing so far, it becomes really expensive to service. When you spread out businesses a long ways, the cost per foot of providing all that infrastructure is really, really high. When you spread things out, and make it very accessible for people to drive all over. That's great. It gives people a lot of mobility options, but you wreck all the incentives to fix up that old building or fix up that strip mall that goes into decline. It's easier just build a new one further out on the edge. And so we've created a development pattern that doesn't hold its value, that is very, very expensive to sustain, and has no real redevelopment mechanism. There's no incentive to actually go back and reclaim it for the most part. It's almost like slash and burn agriculture in that way.
And I think that's, you know, you've described that being the critical difference between historical development patterns and how we build cities now. Being from the Midwest myself, I'm familiar with how much land that was previously put into production for farming and agriculture use that has been turned into cities, whether it be in Illinois. For me, it's a West Des Moines, Iowa, has been as well. So to watch that happen is crazy. And so not only is it the way that we've been developing cities, but it's also some of the policies we've had in place over the years. And with regards to Kansas City, redlining is an impact that has taken a toll on that community. What can be done today to address harmful history like that?
It's really difficult. And it's difficult to, you know, even start to ponder it. Redlining, for people who don't know, was a policy that stemmed from the federal housing policies of the 1930s. The federal government came in during the Depression and tried to prop up the housing market by subsidizing loans, allowing homeowners to switch from local banks to the system we know today. Fannie, Freddie, the secondary market, all that was created during the Great Depression. The problem was the federal government established this system to ensure that taxpayers weren't taking on too much risk with these loans. They designated some neighborhoods as good investments and some neighborhoods as bad investments. And it actually, that makes it sound kind of benign. They designated some neighborhoods as good people, literally, and other neighborhoods as having undesirable people. And in the undesirable neighborhoods, the federal government would not make loans. Those neighborhoods were designated red on the map. And so redlining is the term that has come to mean these neighborhoods. For the most part, those were neighborhoods with descendants of slaves, immigrants, low-income populations. And so what you see is that those neighborhoods have been starved of capital, not only in those early decades of suburban growth, but it's magnified throughout the years. I think there's a paralysis right now in this country about how to deal with some of these issues. And I respect that, and I think that that's, you know, there's an important conversation to be had at state levels and at the federal level. But at the local level, we have a lot of tools that we use right now to attract new businesses, to create growth and opportunities. We have different, you know, tax incentives and subsidies and direct investments that we make routinely. A lot of these are very bad investments. But when we look at struggling neighborhoods, what we find is that there's a series of investments that cities can make that are generally very small and very low risk that actually have a huge financial payoff. And if we combine our desire to not, you know, completely rectify, but at least start moving in the right direction for some of the things that have been done in redlining neighborhoods, there are tools that we have available that we can use to help people reinvest in these neighborhoods, to help people who are there get up and on their feet, to not displace them and kick them out with new development like an opportunity zone might, but to actually help people who are there build their own wealth in the same way that we did in the 50s and 60s with, you know, the non-redline neighborhoods.
One of the many interesting things about the book is the way that you look at the legacy impact of redlining, which is now decades away, and how you can still see the effects of it so dramatically in the nature of land use and land values in places like Kansas City. Again, that's an ebook, I think, that is available on your website and is really interesting. Another piece that I thought was really interesting was the degree to which major urban areas have devoted valuable real estate to parking. Just the enormous resources that are put into parking. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Parking is one of these, once you look at it a certain way, it's hard to unsee it, right?
Exactly.
Parking is from a financial standpoint, parking is an anti-place, right? If you have a building, the building is a place. It's generating tax revenue either through property tax, land tax, employment tax, sales tax. It is for the community wealth. And we can think of it as a community's role as building wealth within the community as a way to sustain itself, to take care of its promises that we all make to each other. Whenever you have parking, you have an anti-place. You have a place that not only does not generate wealth, but actually requires maintenance and liability. It's actually a net negative. When we look at neighborhoods, when we look at places where you're bringing together houses and different, you know, commercial ventures and all this stuff into one place, parking serves as, you know, a declining mechanism. It serves as a depressant to neighborhood growth and vitality. We often think of parking as necessary for businesses, and in some cases it is, up to a point. When you can get a neighborhood going, when you can get things happening, local markets are astounding, and the amount of wealth and prosperity that can be generated in a place is incredible. Parking dampens that. We mandate in most cities, certainly in cities in your listener area, almost everyone exclusively will mandate large amounts of parking for every development that goes in. This stifles small business investment, this stifles entrepreneurship, this stifles startup, and it has the net result of making our cities way more expensive to live in and way less productive financially. We actually lower our tax base while raising our costs just to provide a level of parking that in almost all instances is more than what the market would actually provide.
I have a related question that's not treated in the book, but that you may have a reaction to, which is, what about the implications of self-driving cars that are not owned by individuals? Would that create a dramatic decrease in parking and sort of help to address the problem you're talking about?
You know, there's this promise that it would. And I find that interesting because, I mean, we don't know, right? Cities are dynamic places. When automated vehicles, if they ever reach a point, I'm sure they will at some point, but if they reach a point where they're, you know, used ubiquitously across the landscape, I guess we'll learn and see what happens. I think there's this idea that cars will just circulate around and they won't need to park and it will be great. I'm a little pessimistic on that. I don't know if that's going to be the case. Automated technology works really great in fixed systems. Where you don't have a lot of variables. But when you start to add the complexity of a city, and let me just give you one example. If people start to understand that an automated vehicle will stop for them if they walk out into the traffic flow, you know, if you walk out into the street, the automated vehicles will stop. If that is the safety point we must get to for them to be operable everywhere. But once that becomes the case, why would you not just walk across the street? Why would you sit and wait at a traffic signal for your turn to walk across? You might if you're like a nice, polite Minnesotan. But I've been to New York. I've been to lots of places around this country. People are not going to do that. And so, you know, it would completely defeat the system. It would completely not make it work. We would have to, in a sense, rope off or fence off humans from cars. And if we did that today, automated technology would work just fine, but we would have cities that no one wanted to live in. So I'm a little sanguine. I'm not sure that the automated technology is going to work the way people imagine that it will, but we're just a country obsessed with technology, so we're going to try to, you know, run that experiment regardless.
I don't know why you think that an American population that is somewhat resistant to wearing masks would walk across the street in front of a car, but leaving that aside, as we look at city development, and you talked a little bit about this, but it might be worthwhile to flesh it out a little more. Where, if anywhere, are you seeing municipalities taking the kinds of steps that you would like them to take to change the nature of urban development?
The short answer to that is the poorest communities in North America. I mean, Detroit is doing a lot of incremental work. Shreveport, Memphis. These are places that are not in what we call the illusion of wealth. So, you know, we can all feel rich if we borrow a bunch of money. We can drive nice cars. We can live in nice houses, but our balance sheets are underwater. When we run out of cash flow, when we can't generate enough growth, then we have to face reality. And if you go to some of the poorer places in this country where they can't just instantly generate cash flow, they actually have to deal with the insolvency crisis that this development pattern has created. In those places, you see a lot of adaptation. You see, parking requirements being removed. You see incremental buildings being allowed. You see things like the mother-in-law apartment that takes, four planning commission meetings and all kinds of stuff here in my hometown. You see that just happening by right. And so people can just build, convert their single family home into a duplex, take that strip mall and redevelop it. These are very common things in places that are not pretending that they're rich and affluent. So, yeah, I think the big challenge that we have in places that are still in that early phase of the Ponzi scheme or in that mid phase where they can get enough capital, they can borrow enough money, they can generate enough projects to make things float, we have a built-in resistance to all change. And that's the big challenge for affluent areas, is getting around or getting beyond that resistance to change so that we can start incrementally fixing places. Your last guest talked about having pop-up music venues. Do you know the regulatory bureaucracy you have to go through in most places to do a pop-up music venue, which, is a gorgeous, beautiful thing that we should be allowing to happen all over the place? We need to fix these rules, and not just about music, but about art, about building and development, about, for entrepreneurs and creative people of all stripes. If we do that, we will be learning from some of these poorer places that have already figured out that this is the way you build wealth and success.
So, you've talked about not just building wealth in the community, but you also talk about building wealth of individuals. And one thing that Strong Towns relies on is strong citizens. And it's not that we should anticipate our elected officials to be able to figure this problem out. It's really those that live in the community should be part of that. And so can you tell our listeners how they can find out more about Strong Towns and perhaps be a supporter of this movement?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, we have this huge partisan divide, right? We have this urban, rural, left, right, progressive, conservative divide. And what we find is that at the local level, we all care about the same things. And a lot of that animosity just fades away. So there's a whole movement of people who are trying to make that happen. You can follow us at strongtowns.org. We do 2-3 articles a day. We do 3 different podcasts a week. And we're doing everything we can to share this message with as many people as possible. And yeah, I welcome anyone in your audience to come and be part of that conversation.
Well, we've enjoyed our conversation with you. We've been chatting with Charles Marone. He is with strongtowns.org. You've been listening to Mountain Money, and we'll be right back after this. Small Business Saturday is a day dedicated to support small businesses and communities across the country. It was founded by American Express in 2010, and this day is celebrated each year on the Saturday after Thanksgiving since it started in 2010. Joining us this morning is Jonathan Weidenhammer. He is the Economic Development Director for Park City Municipal, and he's here to help talk with us about the importance of small businesses. John, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So let's just, start about finding out how small businesses have been doing during COVID. So what have you been hearing, and how have been the small businesses in the community been weathering the impacts of COVID?
I don't want to come across as tone deaf, because I think there are a lot of people out there who are really hurting and suffering. But at the same time, we've been impressed by the resiliency of our local businesses and their ability to pivot and make the best of what they can with the current situation. And from July to September, the city was projecting our tax sales tax revenues would be over 30% down. We've actually only been about 5.5% down. The regional drive market, in particular, coming from California and Arizona, Texas, Nevada, has been particularly strong. And when we rely on a regional drive market, traditionally, the spending has been much less, as it's been more local. But this regional drive market has performed incredibly strong, and we're having good sales tax numbers.
I don't know, Jonathan, can you analyze, are they buying different stuff? In other words, you know, we have a traditional tourist market that does one thing. And when you look at the sales tax numbers, are they in different sectors, or is it pretty similar to what we've seen in the past?
No, it's a great question. It is quite a pivot. You know, one interesting trend that we never anticipated was that our galleries and our home furnishing stores are absolutely killing it. We've got lots of people, and the real estate market is hot, coming in and furnishing new homes and new nightly rental markets. And that's another sector that's doing exceptionally well. Our short-term rental market, rentals of homes, which is kind of hard for us to quantify, is performing exceedingly well. The construction industry and certain industries are performing very well. But the tourism-based economies that are traditional, arts, entertainment, recreation, hotels, restaurants, bars, they're really having a tough time, and they're down. You know, they're down 40% in their jobs, and they're down in their sales, and it's been disproportionately impacted. It's been tough.
And I think it's important that you had mentioned that there have been industries that have had strong results over the last few months, but others that have been suffering. And so while you've stated that the city's tax revenue is down only 5%, that doesn't mean business across the board are down 5%. And the city recently completed its CARES Act grant distribution to be able to help these types of businesses. What did you hear from those that applied? Is there a common story that you found that many people were saying?
We do have a common story, but I want to go back to that disproportionately impacted and where the money came from. The Mayor Andy was compelling with the League of Cities and Towns, and going back to all the other communities in Utah, the majority of which by and large have been performing very well from a sales tax standpoint, and having some of that federal CARES money reapportioned into Park City. And we were able to distribute $790,000 to 35 of our local not-for-profits and $1.4 million into 120 small businesses. And what we heard from them by and large was gratefulness, and really hitting them at a time of huge concern and huge need, and really helping shore them up after kind of a rocky fall and going into an uncertain winter, with the goal of really being to make them as sustainable as possible for the you know, rocky future that lies ahead. And people, again, were very grateful.
Jonathan, what are we expecting in terms of losses of businesses over the next 6 months? Are we? I guess it really depends on largely on how much of a ski season we really have. But what, if anything, are you anticipating?
You know, Roger, it's like you mentioned, it's really uncertain. So many of our businesses rely so heavily, probably 70 to 80% of their revenues come from the winter months, and with a starting point seemingly about 50% occupancy is kind of a general trend. It's a little bit murky. I think we're going to have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And I think if another federal round of money is coming in, I think that'll be huge for us. It's really the projections continue to be dire in my mind.
And what can you see? What is the role of the city in trying to help maintain these, you know, the business environment here? What do you see the city doing going forward?
Well, the city's main goal has been to best we can get out of the way, remove artificial impediments and relax enforcement and reduce regulations. You know, the things that in the best of times help promote place and create level playing fields. We really want to focus on reducing regulations like sign codes, and we've taken away paid parking for the summer. And, you know, we've provided a scaled back process to bring up temporary tents and structures so that restaurants and bars and other retail places can have expanded occupancy for the winter. We really want to get government out of the way and help facilitate ease of conducting business and flexibility.
So Park City's atmosphere is quite different than other towns. We've really wanted to make ourselves unique, and we didn't want to be any place USA. And so what you see from that is a ton of small businesses. Can you talk about the importance of small businesses in our community?
Absolutely. Small businesses continue to be, in my opinion, you know, the lifeblood of our authenticity and truly building community character, providing authenticity to Main Street and what's been the historic jewel of our tourism economy, a unique and diverse shopping experience, to the point that the city worked with the Historic Park City Alliance and the Main Street merchants to pass a chain ordinance that only allows 24 chains on all of Main Street. And keeping those small and unique and funky local businesses produces a spending scenario that is really, really beneficial economically to the city and to the community. $100 spent in a small business, of that, about $70 stays local, where a national store, typically only 43 of that stays local. We have what's called a multiplier effect, sometimes in the neighborhood of 3.5 to 4%, four times, where every dollar spent, you see that same dollar spent as much as four times in the same community. So the local bartender has a great night, goes out afterwards, has dinner. That server then turns their money around and spends it in another local store, and so on and so forth. And keeping that money local, having it spent locally, continues to support and provide community character.
And again, with Small Business Saturday coming up this Saturday, which is November 28th, when people come into town or being in town, they should really be spending their money. When we look at this, and again, that multiplier effect, it stays in. So I guess what would you tell our listeners as far as coming this Saturday? What should they be thinking of?
Well, I would be thinking of, you know, the person that lives in town and your friend and your neighbor. If you're not from here, I'd be thinking about, again, helping a small community and spending money locally and spending money that truly makes a difference for real people. And I think, you know, where people get that Black Friday mentality in their mind, the Small Business Saturday to me is a real calling out and a shout out to all the people working hard and trying to make a go of it. And I think if you can spend your money locally, spend your money in a small business, it's truly going to continue to put food on the table for people that we know and people of this community. And I think the Small Business Saturday and what the Historic Park City Alliance is promoting with events on the street and Christmas tree and lighting of the main street lights, I think those are really fun things and a rallying cry. And again, a real time to link in and attach to your small community.
And Jonathan, I know the city has done a number of things you mentioned in the past, you know, for example, the waiving of the parking, which I take it is going to continue for at least the time being.
December 18th is when paid parking comes back.
But Saturday, this weekend, it will be there. Jonathan, any other plans for the city to do different kinds of steps that would change large-scale regulations such as parking?
At the time, Roger, we're in a wait-and-see environment. Again, we want to have a small touch, a small footprint, and we want to be reactive to the business community. Again, the Historic Park City Alliance, the Restaurant Association, Prospector Square Owners Association, all these business districts have really been coming to us and telling us what they need and what we can do to help them. So we've been, again, trying to keep a light touch, but also a very reactive input-based approach. So as the Main Street businesses come to us and tell us what they need, we're more than willing and ready and able to pivot and adjust to their requests.
Jonathan, thank you for spending time with us this morning.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.